Tonight is March 9th, and we are starting Parshas Vayetze, page 144. Parshas Vayetze is the parsha with Yaakov going to Lavan and being at Lavan's house and then returning home. In fact, Parshas Vayetze starts with Yaakov leaving from Be'er Sheva, leaving from Eretz Yisrael, and the very end of Parshas Vayetze is his return. So here, the parsha chronicles his 22 years away from home. And that's what it's about. Now we know, because we've discussed it and we pointed it out last time, that between the end of Parshas Toldos and the beginning of Parshas Vayetze is actually 14 years that are not mentioned in the Torah, they're only hinted to, and that's the 14 years that Yaakov was totally immersed in the study of Torah in preparation for going to Lavan in Parshas Vayetze. We'll see an allusion to it very shortly. But now we begin Parshas Vayetze. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva vayelech Haran. Yaakov left from Be'er Sheva and he went to Haran. Vayifka b'makom. Now, literally this means, and he met in the place. They have it as he encountered the place. Vayolen sham, and he slept there. Kivah HaShemesh, for the sun had set. Vayikach me'avnei ha'makom, and he took from the stones of the place. Vayosem mirashosav, and he put them at his head. Vayishkav ha'makom ahu, and he slept in that place. Notice the word makom, place, mentioned three times in this pasuk. He encountered the place. He slept there. He took from the stones of the place, and he put them by his head, and he slept in that place. So the word makom, place, is being emphasized. Of course, it doesn't tell us what place this is. It just says the place, but it doesn't say where. Vayachalom, and he dreamed, and here's this famous dream. Vine sulam mutsav arza, and behold, a ladder was established on the ground. What do they have for mutsav? They have set on the ground. V'rosho magia hashamayma, and its head reached to the heavens. V'hinei malachei Elokim, and behold, angels of God, olim v'yardim, boat going up and going down on it. V'hinei Hashem nitzav alav v'yomar, and behold, God was standing over him. And he said, standing over him, and he said, God said, Ani Hashem Elokei Avraham Avicha, I am Hashem, the God of Abraham, your father, Ve'elokei Yitzchak, and the God of Yitzchak, Ha'aretz asher atah shochev aleha, the land that you are sleeping on it, Lecha etnena ulezarecha, I will give it to you and to your seed. Ve'olyo zarecha ka'afar ha'aretz, and your seed will be like the dust of the land. Ufaratzta yama v'kema v'tzafon v'anegba, you shall spread out. And they have it as you shall
spread out.
No, spread out powerfully. They have west, east, north, and south. V'nivrechu v'chal kol mishpachoso adama, and all the families of the land will be blessed in you, uvizarecha, and in your seed. V'hinei anochi imach, and behold, I am with you, ushmarticha, and I will guard you, b'chol asher teilech, everywhere you go. V'hashivosicha el ha'adama hazos, and I will return you to this land. Kilo as alchop, for I will not forsake you. Ad asher imasi, see until that which I have done. Es asher dibarti lach, that which I spoke concerning you. I won't forsake you until I fulfill that which I said I was going to do about you.
So is this land different than the land that was promised to Abraham?
Okay, so that's what we need to understand here. Which land are we talking about over here? Let's read two more verses. Vayikatz Yaakov mishenaso, and Yaakov woke up from his sleep. Vayomer, and he said, Achen yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh. It is true, there is God in this place. They said, surely there is God in this place. Ve'anochi lo yaldati, and I didn't know. Again, invoking the term makom, place. Vayira vayomer, and he was afraid, and he said, Ma nora ha'makom hazeh. How awesome is this place? How fearful is this place? Ein zeh ki imbeis Elokim. This is not but the house of God, v'zeh shara shamayim, and this is the gate to heaven. So, again, a reference to makom, place. Now, If the Torah refers to makom, place, and does not tell us what place it is, it must be a very significant place, or a place that we would know what it is. Anytime the letter hey, which is the definite article, the word the is used, habamakom, hamakom, the place, anytime you have a reference like that, it means it's referring to something that we already know about, because it was mentioned before, or a place which is so obvious there's no need to say it. So, for example, it says, Zoveach lo Elohim yacharam. One who offers a sacrifice to the power shall be destroyed. So Rashi over there tells us, what do you mean the power? What power are we talking about? It doesn't say. So clearly it doesn't mean God, because you're supposed to worship God. So clearly it's talking about Avodah Zarah. Clearly it's talking about foreign worship. Anytime you use the definite article, well, for example, excuse me, if it's Sunday at 1 o'clock, and I tell you the class is tonight, what class am I talking about? The only class, of course, that matters. Right? Obviously, I'm talking about our class here tonight. The class is tonight. I don't have to tell you which class we're talking about, because we all know what we're talking about when we're talking about the class. So, if it says the place, it must be referring to a very specific place that is known.
But does that sort of infer that it's where the future Jerusalem is, because that's where we think that you ascend to heaven?
Okay. So, from the fact that in the end, he says this is the house of God, and this yes. is it, right? So, that tips us off as to what place we're talking about. But even before then, it's clear that this is a place which is very significant, which means Herman is correct that Yaakov says this is the place of Hashem, and this is the house of Hashem, and this is the gate to heaven, which means it is the mount of the temple, Temple Mount. It has to be.
Will it be Har HaBayis?
Yes.
Will it be a gate and everything?
Okay, so it's the Har HaBayis, which means it's the Temple Mount, but that's only mentioned later on, because Yaakov says this must be where the house of God is. When the Torah refers to it as the place, it must have a significance other than the fact that it's the Temple Mount, because it's not yet the Temple Mount. So it must. But what is significant about Yerushalayim? What is significant about it that he calls it the place, or that the Torah calls it the place? What is significant about it? So really, during you said it. Okay, because the Akedah Yitzchak has already taken place over here. There has already been a significant event.
So that's the burning bush.
The burning bush is at Har Sinai.
Okay.
That's later. So there has already been a significant event, and that was the binding of Yitzchak, which took place over here. So when it says the place, we already know that this place has significance, even before Yaakov tips us off and tells us this is going to be where the Beis HaMikdash will eventually stand.
So wait, the altar then that Abraham built after the Akedah, that wouldn't have been there?
I might have been there. It might have been there.
Wouldn't he have known this is a special place because there's an altar?
Okay, so you're asking a good question, but first explain to us where do you see that he did not know? You're asking a good question, but show us, how do we know that Yaakov did not know the significance of this place?
Well, why did he end up Bethel?
Okay, as opposed to?
Because there is a place in Israel called Bethel.
True, that's true.
But it's not in Jerusalem.
Right. That's right. Good. That's a good point.
He said he was frightened, and had he known where he was, maybe he wouldn't have... It's not like he was frightened that he went to sleep, but maybe he wouldn't have been frightened, or maybe he wouldn't have gone to sleep had he known where he was.
Okay, it seems...
But he said, I didn't know this was a holy place.
That's right. He says,
there,
I didn't know.
Something there, he should have known okay. that was a holy
So Yaakov place. Doesn't realize where he's sleeping. He doesn't know where he is. He has left Eretz Yisrael, going to Haran. He seems to have gotten to this place, and the sun is going down, so he goes to sleep. And when he has this dream, he wakes up and he says, I didn't know. I didn't realize. So Yaakov doesn't seem to be aware of it. So how could that be? Isn't the place where his father had been bound, where you had the Akedah Yitzchak, wouldn't you think that's a place that would be well known, at least for Yaakov? And what about that altar that was built? It seems to be very strange if you wouldn't know where he was. So we first need to understand, how come Yaakov did not know where he was? wouldn't it have been obvious to him?
Then what is it significant? It said that he placed his head on a stone.
Oh, there's stones, yeah. And later it turned, yeah.
Yeah, but would that be normal to sleep on a stone?
Okay.
Under a stone?
Right, so it doesn't actually say that he's put his head down on the stone, although that seems to be how they understand it.
Yeah.
It says he put stones at his head. Rashi tells us to protect him from wild animals when he went to sleep.
Okay. Okay.
But they do say, the Medrash seems to say that he actually laid his head down on the stone.
Yeah.
It does seem that way. So that seems like a pretty rough way to fall asleep.
Well, he took something else and put it on there too.
Could have put like a
stone. He had to raise his head so he'd be comfortable.
Okay. Did he have anything else?
His clothing.
He put a piece of clothing.
If he had any.
If he had any.
So we assume he did because he was traveling.
Right.
He had luggage. Okay. So. The Gemara says, the Talmud tells us as follows. Let's go back to the first pasuk. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva vayelech Haran. Yaakov leaves Be'er Sheva and he goes to Haran. Vayifga b'makom is that's a very funny phrase. And he encountered in the place. Vayolen Sham, and he slept there. Kiva Hashemesh, for the sun had set. So Rashi tells us, it's a funny way to put it. First of all, to meet the place is a funny thing to say. He encountered the place. What does that mean? You don't encounter a place. You walk onto a place. You encounter a person. You encounter something which, as you're going, it all of a sudden shows up. Like, for instance, I guess you could say you encountered a lost object. You encountered a $20 bill on the road. I guess you could say that. But you wouldn't encounter a piece of ground. You walked onto the piece of ground. Moreover,
didn't Hashem make the distance shorter for him so he'd get there faster?
Okay, good. So that's a good point. Also, it says that he slept there for the sun had set. So Rashi says that's a funny way to put it. That sounds like
the sun set early.
It sounds like he went to sleep because the sun had set. He wasn't expecting the sun to set. And he was expecting to go on his journey, and all of a sudden the sun is setting, so he went to sleep.
But encounter sounds like it. Something is resisting to get that.
Mm-hmm.
Encounters, you have to capture something to.
It takes a little.
Isn't God stopping him in this spot, making it all of a sudden strike?
Yeah, okay.
So maybe he didn't see the altar then.
Okay, so our sages say this as follows. Yaakov left Be'er Sheva. Be'er Sheva is in the south of Eretz Yisrael. Now, Yerushalayim is north of Be'er Sheva. He was traveling north. He was traveling north, and then he was going to veer east to Haran. So he traveled. He went past where Yerushalayim is, where the Temple Mount is, and he went all the way to Haran. That's the first pasuk says. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva vayelech Haran. He left Be'er Sheva and he went to Haran. He actually went all the way there. Yaakov then said to himself, one second, I passed by the Temple Mount. I passed by that place which Yitzchak was bound there, and I didn't stop. I didn't do anything there. How could I just go right past it? So he turned around and came back. He immediately turned around and came back. Hashem, when he saw that Yaakov was coming back, actually took the mountain and moved the mountain further north. So that when Yaakov was returning from the north, going back south into Eretz Yisrael, the mountain literally uprooted itself and was moved further north. So Yaakov got there, encountered it, and he didn't expect it. Not only did he not expect it, he didn't know what it was. Because it was not the location of where the Temple Mount is, it was moved further north. So he would have kept on going. So in order to stop him there, Hashem didn't want him to keep on going. Hashem caused the sun to set quickly. Now it's dark. Well, there are no street lights, not in those days. So he went to sleep. What else did he do at night? So he went to sleep, not realizing that he was in fact on the Temple Mount. And when that happens, he has this dream. And when he wakes up, he realizes, oh boy, this is no ordinary place. I'm clearly on the Temple Mount. I didn't realize that had happened. And he says this is the house of God, and this is the gate to heaven. Now, it's an interesting medrash, how to read the psukim. What do we take from there? Yaakov had been studying for 14 years. He's now ostensibly very close to God. Now he's set and he's ready to go to Lavan. And he leaves. He's prepared. He studies for 14 years straight in order to prepare himself, to fortify himself, so that when he goes to Lavan, Lavan will not hurt him spiritually. That he's prepared to be there in the house of Lavan and remain steadfast into Judaism. So he goes. He gets to Haran, and he says, oh boy, I forgot something very important. And he turns around and he comes back. So he had studied 14 years, getting very close to God, and still forgot to stop at the Temple Mount. Wouldn't you have thought that someone who is on the spiritual level of Yaakov, the first thing he would want to do is get closer to God, is to go ascend what would eventually become the Temple Mount and pray over there? But no, he just goes right past it.
Hashem may not have told him where the Temple Mount was prior to that.
Well, I would imagine he would know only because that was where his father had been bound. And actually, Yaakov says, I want to go back there. So he knows there is such a thing.
He had a mission. It was on his mind to get to Lavan.
After 14 years? It's been a long time.
He had to be there. He had to get, you know, the girls have been born now. He had to get there.
Now, moreover, this place, this Temple Mount, this place where Akedat Yitzchak took place, actually had, it's mentioned, it's hinted to, in several other places in the Torah. Not just here, but we've actually had it a few times before. What's the first time, where is the first time that a sacrifice is offered in the Torah?
In Cain and Hevel.
Cain and Abel. Where did that take place?
I guess it was there.
It was there. Right? Very good. Now, when Abraham goes to pray for Sodom, he goes to pray, it says, he goes to pray, and the verse says, this I'm going to let me show it to you very clearly. We pointed this out when we studied it the first time, but now you'll see more significantly.
Rabbi, doesn't that sort of indicate in my little interpretation that Hashem is giving him free will, and that as mankind does have, but then he then intervened to give him directions at that point.
Okay.
He didn't know the place.
Right. Okay, so we need to get back to him. Why he intervened. That's very good. But let me show you something. Back, keep the place over here, but back on page 84. Excuse me, that's not the right place. I'm sorry. Hold on.
You didn't bring any extra
sauce? Screwed up again.
Verse 88. I'm sorry, page 88. Page 88. Remember, Abraham had prayed for Sodom, and then God destroys Sodom. And remember, we talked about how it wasn't a failure. It seems that it's a failure, but it wasn't a failure. We also talked about how the next day, Abraham goes back and prays in the same place that he did before. So on page 88, verse 27, Chav Zayin, Vayashkem Abraham Baboker, Abraham woke up early in the morning, El Hamakom, to the place, Asher Amad Shamas Pnei Hashem, that he had stood there facing at the face of God. Again, this word Hamakom, the place. What's the place? the same place we're talking about over here. That's where Abraham had prayed for Sidon. He had prayed on the Temple Mount.
I don't know why, but I ever heard of it. Is that an implied God?
Yes. Hamakom is another way to refer to God himself, the place. Because God is not in any place. All places are somewhere, I don't know if you call it in him or around, but God is not contained anywhere, so he's the place. So he is referred to that way. But here, you see this same word referring to Abraham praying in the place. Yitzchak later, at the end of Parshas Chaye Sarah, it says that he went out to pray in the field. That's also referring to the same place, to the Temple Mount. Chazal tells us, our sages say, Abraham established, he coined Shacharis, the morning prayer. That's right here. Yitzchak established Mincha, when he went out to pray in the afternoon, in the same place. And here Yaakov is establishing Ma'ariv, the evening prayer. The three patriarchs established the three prayers, all of them on the Temple Mount. Now, Avraham establishes Shacharis, Yitzchak Mincha, Yaakov Ma'ariv. That's the three. Avraham, who establishes Shacharis, the morning prayer, is a reflection of Avraham's life, because he's the one who begins the whole thing. He starts off the whole religion. He's the one who finds God for the first time. And therefore, he establishes the prayer of Shacharis, which is in the morning, the sun is coming up, the whole day is ahead of us, we feel refreshed and ready to go. That's what Abraham established. Yitzchak establishes Mincha, because Mincha really is that prayer which is the bridge between the morning and the night. And Yitzchak also reflects that as being the bridge between Abraham and Yaakov. Yaakov establishes Ma'ariv, the evening prayer, because Yaakov, of the three patriarchs, is the one who will spend 20 years in Gullus, in exile. And Gullus, exile, is compared to the night. Not only that, but the end of Yaakov's life will be in which country?
Mitzrayim.
In Mitzrayim, in Egypt, not in Israel. So Yaakov is the patriarch, he's the one of the Avos that most closely is associated with Gullus, with exile, with not being in Israel. And that's what Ma'ariv is about. It's an evening prayer when the sun goes down, when things look bleak, and you're waiting for the morning. That's where you daven and pray to God to protect us. And that's what Yaakov established. Now, Yaakov, when he left Israel, he didn't forget about God, but he didn't establish the prayer. He didn't establish this third prayer. And that was crucial for Yaakov's mission. Because Yaakov is now leaving and going into this dark exile. And during that time, he needs to pray to Hashem that he'll protect him. And here he didn't do it. So he leaves Israel, gets to Haran, and says, one second, I didn't establish the next prayer, which means as follows. When each one of the patriarchs establishes a prayer, as I just mentioned, that reflects their own mission. So Abraham established Shacharis when his mission was becoming fulfilled. When he was performing his mission, that's when he establishes Shacharis. Yitzchak establishes Mincha right before he marries Rivka. And that's when his mission begins to take form. Yaakov's main mission is going to be with Lavan. When he leaves Israel and goes, until this point in his life, he's been preparing for his mission, but he hasn't actually performed it. His mission is going to be to marry and have the 12 tribes and successfully establish the new Jewish people. That's what his mission is. His first 77 years, he has not been in a position to actually perform his mission. But now that he's leaving and going to Haran, this is when he's about to actively perform his mission. Now's the time he has to establish that prayer. So he leaves, he forgets to do it, then realizes he needs to remember, and he comes back and establishes the prayer. Now, we know a very important fact. Maise avos simin labonim. Whatever happens to the patriarchs is symbolic of what happens to us, to the children. Abraham went down to Egypt, and they tried to take Sarah from him. We went down to Egypt, and they tried to make us into slaves. And then we got out. The different events that happen to the avos affect us. Yaakov not remembering about establishing the prayer at the Temple Mount means it is symbolic of something for us in the future. At the same time, when he does remember and returns, God says, oh, he's coming back to me. I'm actually going to go and meet him. I'll move the mountain and make his trip shorter. Now, why does he deserve that? If Yaakov forgot, so he now deserves a miracle that the mountain should move closer to him? Wouldn't you think that, hey, you know, you forgot the first time, so come all the way back?
Because Hashem always tells us, we have to initiate and Hashem helps us the rest of the way.
Okay, so that's for sure true. We initiate, and then God helps us the rest of the way. That's a guarantee that we have. Habala Taher Messiah. Someone who is coming for purity, then from upstairs they help him out. A person sets their mind towards purity, towards holiness, and God will assist us. God will help us out. But it's more than that. If a person forgets, here, he forgot to stop at the mountain, and he kept going. So that demonstrates a lapse. That was not a good thing, to forget. But when a person forgets, and then endeavors to return, that doesn't just show that the person is now coming back to what they should have done, but the effort it takes to return is more difficult than the effort would have been in the first place to simply have gone onto the mountain. Had he remembered in the first place, it would have been relatively simple. On the way, oh, you know what, let me just go up the mountain, establish a prayer, and then move on. But now that he went and forgotten how to come back, the forgetting may have been bad, but the returning is much more difficult to do. And he did it. God says, you putting in the effort to return, I'm going to make it easier and move the mountain closer. This is meant to be symbolic of Teshuvah, of our journey through Golus, our journey through the exile that we're in. We may have gone and at some point forgotten about God, forgotten our mission, forgotten that we have to establish ourselves with our mission. And that is not a good thing. But once we remember and we return, which is much more difficult than it would have been had we put in the effort in the first place. Coming back is a lot harder. Correcting mistakes is a lot harder than not making them in the first place. So once we are correcting the mistake, Hashem says, oh, you're coming towards me? I'm moving the mountain. I'll uproot an entire mountain in order to meet you partway. Because you're putting in that effort. And that's what Yaakov does over here as well. This is the Maisa Avo Simon Labanim. That's symbolic of the future.
So that'll be the coming of Mashiach? If we do it right?
I think it's on many levels. I think the coming of Mashiach, yes, that will happen there as well. But I think it's on many levels. I think it's on individual levels. And I think it also is something which you see throughout Jewish history, where although there have been lapses in our history where we have not acted as we should, but once the Jewish people turn around and say, that's it, we are now unified in returning to Hashem, we find all the time that the road gets paved very quickly. That in an incredibly short time, things are reestablished. After European Jewry was destroyed, and Jews came here to these shores and attempted to reestablish ourselves, in the 1950s, nobody thought that there was going to be any more religiosity in Judaism. It was doomed. There was nothing. All that had been was gone. There were no schools. There were very few institutions. Most shuls were were leaving religiosity, moving away from religion. The kashrus was in a dismal state. Things were crumbling. Had that trend continued today, you wouldn't recognize Judaism in America. There wouldn't be any Judaism. Mm-hmm. And then there was an unbelievable turnaround where people said, no, we're going to stay steadfast in religion, and we're going to stay steadfast in our commitment to Hashem. And in an incredible way, really, a way that defies the natural order, things turned around. And we Jews have rebuilt ourselves on these shores in ways that are unbelievable. And in a relatively short time, how long have the Jewish people really had a presence here? It's true there were Jews that came over in the late 1800s, early 1900s, but by the 50s, things were just moving further and further away from the Torah. And now, it's incredible, the Renaissance. So once we make it our business to turn around towards God, God meets us. He moves a mountain towards us. There's an important point to make over here, which many of you may be familiar with, which is that, and tell me the answer if you know the answer, in the very first verse, it says, Yaakov left Beersheba and went to Charan. And so, our sages asked the obvious question, which is, if he went to Charan, he obviously left Beersheba. There's no need to say he left Beersheba. Clearly, if he went to Charan, he left Beersheba. You can't be in two places at once. Why does the Torah need to point out to us that he left Beersheba?
Far distance, and Hashem made it quick for him.
So okay, that's a good answer.
But isn't it that he was a great person, and when a great person leaves, and there's almost like a void left behind?
That's right. That's right. The sages say that when a tzaddik is located in a place, the tzaddik is the glory of that place. He is its glory. When he leaves, the glory is removed from the place. The grandeur of that place is removed. Yaakov was an incredible tzaddik, as we're about to point out. I'll show you reference that in a moment. And when he left Beersheba, the stature of Beersheba became diminished. Now this is a striking thing to say, because Yaakov wasn't the only tzaddik in Beersheba. Well, Avram had already passed away. But Yitzchak was in Beersheba. Rivka was in Beersheba. His parents were in Beersheba.
Where was the yeshiva of Shimon?
It's not clear where that was. I don't think it was in Beersheba. I suspect it was in Yerushalayim. That's what I suspect. Because that's where Shem was. But I don't know for sure. So Yaakov leaves Beersheba. Then he removes the glory and the grandeur from Beersheba. So it's inescapable that we have to say one of two things. Either that even if you have three great tzaddikim in the city, but if one leaves, it still removes the grandeur and the greatness of the place. Not completely, because you still have two other tzaddikim there, but everyone counts. And if he leaves, it diminishes the grandeur of the place. Or we have to say that even though Yitzchak and Rivka are still alive, and they certainly are great tzaddikim, but the torch has already been passed. As we spoke about the past few times, the torch has now been passed to Yaakov. Yitzchak and Rivka, although they are still alive, but their role in forming the Jewish people is done. They have done what they've done what they've done. Rivka has engineered everything we spoke about in Parshas Toldos. Yitzchak has carried out his mission in delivering the brachos and raising. They both raised Yaakov. And now their mission is done. Now, obviously, I don't mean they're done. That now there's no reason for them to live anymore. But their mission towards the Jewish people is done. They still have what to live for. They still have what to contribute to the world. But in terms of their contribution to forming the Jewish people, they have done their part. And so Yaakov really then is now the glory and the grandeur of the city of Be'er Sheva, and when he leaves, he takes that glory and grandeur with him. There's another person about whom this is said. And when this person left a certain place, the glory and grandeur went with this person.
I'm thinking it's Abraham, but I don't remember.
It doesn't say it with Abraham. It may have been true, but it doesn't say it. There's another place where it actually says the same language, that this person left a certain place and went to another place. And there's no reason to say that they left that place. And that is Naomi. Naomi, with Rus, it says over there, Vateitse mina makoma shehaisa shama, and her two daughters-in-law were with her, and she went on the road. It says she left the place that she had been there, and she went on the road to return to the land of Yehuda, to the land of Judah. So she was a tzadekes, not just any tzadekes. She was an incredibly righteous woman. And when she left that place, she took all its grandeur with her. Now she was the only tzadekes in that place. That place was the fields of Moab. And when she left the fields of Moab to return to Israel, she took with her any greatness and grandeur that had been in the fields of Moab, because she was the tzadekes, and she's the one who had brought righteousness to that place. Yaakov, when he gets to Lavan's house, as we will find later, has nothing with him. He has no money. He has no gifts to offer. We will see this later in Parashas Vayetze. Now, Yaakov was traveling. How does he not have anything with him? He knew he was going to be traveling. He didn't leave without packing a bag. Why does he have nothing with him when he gets to Laban's house?
Because Alphaz, which is the son of Esau,
okay,
ran after him to kill him.
Right.
And Yaakov said, take everything I have, because like you're leaving me like I'm dead without nothing.
Esau sent his son Eliphaz, his eldest son, to chase after Yaakov and kill him. Esav himself did not want to attack Yaakov. As we mentioned the past few times we studied together, Yaakov was a very powerful person. And Rivka herself says that if Esav attacks you, you're going to kill him. So Yaakov, Esav perhaps was not really confident himself in attacking Yaakov. Plus, Esav has to worry about his father Yitzchak. Esav does not want to do anything that will pain his father Yitzchak personally. But he sends his son, Eliphaz, to go and avenge him, avenge the taking of the blessings, and kill Yaakov. So Eliphaz runs after Yaakov. Now here, it is perhaps startling to note that it seems Eliphaz could have killed Yaakov. It seems that Eliphaz was more powerful than Yaakov, which means Eliphaz must have been unbelievably powerful. Because if Esav, who is the top warrior of the world, would have been killed had he attacked Yaakov. So Yaakov is more powerful than the top warrior of the world. Yet, Esav's son Eliphaz seems to have been able, had he tried, to kill Yaakov. Because he catches up with Yaakov, and now he's ready to kill him. And Yaakov, and Eliphaz says, I want to kill you, but I can't do it. I'm not going to do it. Why? Because Eliphaz grew up, it says, on the lap of his grandfather Yitzchak. Yitzchak is the father of Esav. Esav's son Eliphaz, his Zeta, is Yitzchak. Because he grew up bechiko shel Yitzchak, in the embrace of Yitzchak, he couldn't bring himself to kill Yaakov. So he says to his uncle Yaakov, he says, I can't do it. My father told me to kill you, but I can't do it. But what do I do? My father told me to do it. I can't ignore my father. It's kibud av, the honor of my father. Because Esav is known, what's that?
But it's against the Torah. And
Esav is known for honoring his father. His son Eliphaz is also known for honoring his father. He says, I can't not kill you. My father told me to do it. So Yaakov says to him, here, take everything I have, leave me penniless. And the Gemara tells us that a poor person, meaning completely destitute, is compared to a dead person. Why is a poor person compared to a dead person? Someone with absolutely nothing. Okay, dead person is absolutely nothing. A poor person is absolutely nothing. A poor person, his ability to affect the world, to affect other people, is extremely, extremely limited because he has no resources. We're talking about someone who has absolutely nothing, just the shirt on their back. So Yaakov says, take everything I have, then I'm considered as if I'm dead, and you can and then that way you have fulfilled your father's wishes.
But wasn't that after the part where he's gone back and God has already promised to take care of him?
No, that's before here.
That's before he went to Yeshiva.
It's before Vayetze.
Oh, okay.
So Yaakov had nothing. So when he got to the place where he lay down, and we talked about putting his head on a stone, he didn't have anything. He couldn't put anything under his head. He didn't have anything. Bear that in mind, because we're going to see he does have something in the end. And we'll see in a minute what that is. Now, Yaakov goes to sleep in that place. It is from here that we derive that he did not sleep normally for the previous 14 years because he was studying Torah. We talked about this last time we studied, that his sleeping in that place, this was a novel thing. He had not slept typically, the typical way one sleeps at night, for the past 14 years. And here he does. And he dreams and he sees a ladder. And on the ladder, and the ladder is its feet on the ground, and it's going all the way up to the heavens. And he sees angels of God ascending, and descending the ladder. Why were angels ascending and descending the ladder?
Because the angels that were with him in the land were leaving, and now different angels are going to accompany him from the Chutz Laaretz.
Okay, this is the simple answer. I want to tell you that there are probably, okay, I don't want to say the most, this is probably one of the most spoken of psukim in the Midrashim. There is an unbelievable amount of Midrashim explaining what these angels were doing going up and going down. There are many answers to this question, and they're all right. They're not mutually exclusive. But there's much symbolism that's going on over here with the angels ascending and descending. We'll talk about a few of them. We can't cover all of them. We'll talk about a few of them.
You said we were learning with Yecheskel that one of them was they were going up and seeing the face.
Okay, perfect. Good. So first let's talk about what Mrs. Starkman said, which is that the angels were those angels that were accompanying him in Israel were leaving, and new angels were coming down to accompany him in Chutz Laaretz, and outside of Israel. Every person really has accompanying angels. This is something which in previous generations was taken for granted, that each one of us has accompanying angels. In fact, the Talmud tells us an unbelievable thing. The Gemara says that before one enters a bathroom, before one enters, in those days it would be an outhouse, what one should do is turn to his angels and say to them a little prayer, a little supplication. Obviously you can't pray to the angels, it's praying to God, but it's saying to the angels, wait a minute, I'll be right back. Just don't go away. I'm going in for a few minutes, I'll be out in a few minutes, hang around. It says, it's Hiskavdu Mechuvadim, which is in honor of those honorable ones who are accompanying me. There's a little prayer, a little supplication to say, to ask the angels, really asking God to have the angels, wait outside while one goes in, does what they have to do, and then comes back out, and his angels are with him again. We no longer say that prayer, because we don't believe that we are on the spiritual level that we deserve to actually have those angels hanging around with us. And therefore, we don't say that prayer because that prayer seems like it would be haughty for someone to think that I have angels with me, so I need to tell my angels to hold on a minute. When else, we don't think about angels regularly, so for us to have the presumption that we have angels, that's a little too far.
Angels at night.
We believe that Hashem protects us with angels. That's true. You mean when we go to bed at night,
yeah.
We sing. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that we have accompanying angels that walk with us everywhere we go. When we go to sleep at night, we know that when we recite Shema before we go to sleep, that means God is going to protect us. He offers us a measure of protection. It says in the Gemara, if you say Shema before you go to sleep, that gives you protection. So we believe that He protects us with His angels at night. But but to say that we have angels walking around with us all the time, we don't believe that we're on that level. Yaakov certainly was. But the angels that are considered Israeli angels are not the same as non-Israeli angels, diaspora angels. You got two different types of angels. So this
direct messages to Hashem.
That's what the angels right. That's what angels do. They be your right, connected to God. So, but the angels that were his Israeli angels leave, and the diaspora angels come down. Hold the place over here. If you look at the very end of Parshas Vayetze, when Yaakov returns from his trip to Laban's house, on page 168, the second to last verse in the parasha, which happens to be Pasuk Beis, verse 2, it says, "Vayakov halach ledarko." Yaakov went on his way. "Vayifku uvo malachei Elokim," and angels of God met him. Angels of God met him. What angels of God? So the simple meaning is that here in the beginning of the parasha, the Israeli angels go up the ladder, and the diaspora angels come down the ladder. And then when he gets back to Israel, he meets the Israeli angels who are coming out to greet him and escort him back into Israel.
But here, if we're saying that it was on the Temple Mount that he was, that's not the borderline.
He hadn't quite left yet. Right. It seems that because he's on his way out, they come down. When he comes back as well, the Israeli angels actually come out of Israel and meet him outside to escort him in.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. The Temple Mount is in Eretz Israel.
Right.
Even though God moved it.
Right.
Haran is not.
Right.
Haran is outside Eretz Israel.
That's right.
Okay, so he's still in Eretz Israel.
That's right.
At the point when he lays down.
That's right.
So he can everything go up.
That's right.
So we haven't gotten there yet, but to the next part where God promises him all this land for his descendants, he already promised that to Abraham.
Right. Good. Good. Okay, that's a good point. That's a good point. We're going to get to that. Your question? No. Now, first of all, you see that he has to have a different set of angels. Why would he need a different set of angels? Why can't there be one set of angels? Why do you have to have Israeli angels and non-Israeli angels?
Does it need to do with their specialized...
Okay. When one is living in Israel, one has a different mission than when one leaves Israel. When one is in Israel, there is one relationship with God. And when one leaves Israel, one has a different relationship with God. Really, we know that we all belong in Israel. It's not possible right now for all of us to be there. But we know that it's ultimately where a Jew belongs, is in Israel. That's our place. The angels that accompany those who deserve to have angels accompany them, the ones, when one is in Israel, there's one sort of angel, because an angel represents the connection with God, really, as Herman said before. The connection each one of us has with God is represented by these angels. There's one type of connection in Israel and a different type outside of Israel. Outside of Israel, we are more distant from God than we are inside of Israel. Moreover, the dangers outside of Israel, the spiritual dangers, are greater. And so the angels that accompany Yaakov outside of Israel have to be a different type of angel, the type that represents a certain distance from God, but yet more of a protection. It is worthwhile noting that in the beginning of the parsha, when the angels leave and switch, you have the changing of the guard. When that happens, Yaakov perceives it how? How does he see it? Through what medium? How does he know what's happening?
Through a dream.
Through a dream. At the end of the parsha, when Yaakov comes back, there's no mention of a dream. He's walking along the road and he meets angels of God. No dream. He just meets the angels.
He's a higher spiritual.
Correct. Correct. Yaakov grows. He grows exponentially. Personal growth over the next 22 years that this parasha spans. It's not just that he's grown 22 years older and he's grown closer to God, but the experiences that he endures in this terrible exile with Lavan make him a better person. He grows from the experience. So that in the beginning of the parasha, everything is shown to him through a dream, and at the end of the parasha, he's wide awake. It's a different experience. So even though the experience is going to be a difficult one, but he's going to grow from it and come closer to God than he was before. Another explanation for, this is what Mrs. Kaiser was mentioning, for why the angels were going up and down is because there is, for those who attend the Wednesday night Yechezkel class, we know that on God's throne and God's chariot, we know that there are four faces on the chariot of God, on the throne of God. We don't understand this fully. You know, we're not going to understand fully things that go on in the chariot of God. But the four faces, one is a lion, one is an eagle, one used to be an ox and then it was changed to a cherub, and one is the face of a man. Each one of those faces represents a different koach, a different power in the world. And we talked about this extensively when we read this in Yechezkel. Obviously, the face of man represents man, mankind. But each one of those faces is meant to show the quintessential of each one of those things. Meaning, the lion is not any lion, it's the quintessential lion. The eagle is not any eagle, it's the quintessential eagle. The man that appears on the throne of God is not any man, it's the quintessential man. That which is the person who represents what God has in mind for all of mankind. Yaakov here was sleeping on the Temple Mount. And the Medrash says the angels were coming down the ladder to see who was sleeping on the Temple Mount. And they saw a face that looked very familiar to them. And they went up the ladder to look at the throne of God, where they saw the same face. And they went back down the ladder to make sure. And say, one second, I had the same. Oh, look at that. Get a load of this. And then they would go up and see the face. It's the same face. Is it the same face? Go down the ladder. Look at that face. They were astounded to find that the face of Yaakov on this mortal man is the same face that's found on the throne of God. And they were going up and down the ladder to go look at one and look at the other. That's what one of the Midrashim says was going on over here. Yaakov is the person who is the embodiment of all of the hopes of mankind. He is where mankind is headed. This is where we want to be. He's the goal. That's now. That's before he goes to Lavan. And remember, after he goes to Lavan, he's going to become even better. So, but at this point in his life, at age 77, he so perfectly resembles that face on the throne of God that even the angels are astounded. And this brings out a very, very important point. And that important point is, and we'll see this theme throughout the Chumash, that important point is that for all the greatness of the angels, and angels are very powerful, very perfect beings. They don't have free will, so they don't mess themselves up by choosing evil over good. They are the way God made them, and they do exactly what God tells them to do. That's an angel. And an angel is a powerful being. And therefore, they are particularly close to God. Human beings, we, are not as close to God as angels are. But we have the capacity to become even better than the angels. Because angels are what they are. They're the way God made them. Human beings, through our struggle, through our overcoming our evil inclination and doing battle with our evil inclination and having the challenges that angels don't have, we can actually become better than the angels themselves. This theme is brought up by Moshe later on in the Chumash. And Mirza Shem, when we get there, we can talk about that. But here you see Yaakov was a man that the angels were shocked to find was on the throne of God. The angel is not on the throne of God, but rather the face of man is. Because this face of man, this Yaakov, can become even better than the angels. And this was what they were going up and down looking at to see that face. So Yaakov, we are introduced to here in the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, is almost perfect. Nobody's perfect, but he's nearly perfect. He's leaving and going to a very imperfect place. He's been growing up for his first 63 years in perhaps the most perfect home with parents like Yitzchak and Rivka. Then he spends 14 years completely engrossed in the study of Torah. He's very nearly perfect. And now he's going to a place which is corrupt. And it's going to be his challenge to maintain his perfection during his stay with Lavan. We know that when he comes back from Lavan, in the next parasha, in Parashas Vayishlach, he sends a message to Esav. And the message he sends to Esav is, Im Lavan Garti, I lived with Lavan. And what's the rest of that line? V'taryag mitzvah shamarti, and I guarded all 613 commandments. I did not succumb to my evil inclination, even while I was at Lavan's house. Therefore, Esav, don't think that you have any power over me. You and I both know, Esav, that when I fail, you then become more powerful than me. But I stood the test. And not only that, but if I stood the test over there, I'm even better than I was before. So don't attack me, Esav, because just like you couldn't beat me before, you can't beat me now either. That was the message that Yaakov sent to Esav when he returns from his sojourn with Lavan. So that's Parashas Vayetze that we're going to see. We now, for next week, we have to begin with this actual prophecy that God tells Yaakov, and as Dadi brought up, and talk about that a little bit, and talk about his making, his putting up of this altar.